Do you think that the general person or the general American or even maybe the general reader, have they just lost curiosity, David? I mean, it was a point in time when I think things like curiosity and critical thinking were obviously promoted and championed. Do you think we've lost a little bit of that? I mean, people just sort of follow, you know, whatever their friends are telling them or whatever they see at the top of their timeline happens to be what they follow these days, or?
I think so. Yeah, I think we have, there's a level to which the news became, rather than informing yourself, became entertainment. And then now it's, as a form of entertainment, it competes with, you know, if that's all it is to most people, a lot of people, then, you know, it's going to be competing with just aimless scrolling. It's going to be competing on social media. It's going to be competing with video games. It's going to be competing. A lot of people spend their time. I saw something about free time, that we actually have more and more and more free time, but almost all of it has been spent on social media. Mm. And they call it screen time, I think is what they called it. But yeah, watching TV, streaming things, social media, video games. So we have a lot of time, and then that kind of infotainment, or, you know, that I think the news becomes that. And then you might be getting a very shallow understanding of a lot of things as you scroll, but mm. you're talking about curiosity. They might not be picking one of those things to, okay, I've seen a lot of headlines and read a lot of opinions and comments about Israel and Palestine. What if I were to actually learn a lot about it and read about, you know, the Balfour Declaration, or, you know, how the 1948 partition of it, and just really, like, how did all that come to be? Then maybe you get that
context.
Rather than the shallow, just dive down a little bit into those things that you've been reading about shallowly. You can really actually have an educated opinion on them.
No, I totally agree. And I, you know, I have a piece in the Carolina Journal about the rise of populism and sort of how that has detracted a lot of people from traditional conservative values. And for my audience, if you haven't went to the Carolina Journal and read that piece, certainly I encourage you to go find them on Facebook or X, or just go to the website, Carolina Journal. And I do think that when people lose that curiosity or they lose that critical thinking, that is where you can see just this surge of populism on either side of the aisle. It doesn't necessarily have to be on the right side. It can be on the left side, but it becomes a lot easier for people to take advantage of how you might, your emotions around a particular subject and an issue versus, you know, you utilizing your critical thinking ability to learn more about the context related to that issue.
The John Locke Foundation started back in 1990 as kind of a pure ivory tower academic style think tank. And continued in that way for a long time, added on Carolina Journal sometime 1993, 1994 as a journalism arm. And then in 2005, the late Jack Hawk used to be chairman, and I think at some point he was executive director of the North Carolina GOP, along with Art Pope and a few other people, founded the Civitas Institute. And Civitas was supposed to be more of that rapid response and commentary type think tank, as opposed to the academic side of John Locke Foundation. But as your audience probably knows, if they're watching or listening, they do know, people, normal everyday people, have access to more information than ever before. It's crazy the amount of information that we can get about state budgets and school performance and economics and the consumer price index and all of this stuff. And so while the Locke Foundation's original audience was mostly lawmakers, and the Civitas Institute's audience was mostly grassroots folks, as people are more informed over time, our audience has started doing this. And so when Amy Cook was CEO here at the John Locke Foundation, we started talking, and, you know, we both just wanted what's best for North Carolina and to have a more effective organization. And we were having to become more and more similar, and it was getting a little silly. you know, how does Civitas get the press release out before the John Locke Foundation does, and that sort of thing. And, you know, should we really be in competition with each other, or should we really be finding ways in which we can advance free market principles for North Carolina? And so we decided, and with the support of our board of directors, to merge. And we did that on January 1st, 2021.
Yeah. Not only crowding out National Fence, but we've got some real actual issues right here in our own backyard. I know oftentimes we like to pretend we have no problems, and, you know, we stand ready to come to the rescue of so many other countries in the world. But, you know, we have a housing crisis still in this country, specifically here in North Carolina, where there's so many people moving into the state, but they can't find quality, affordable housing. And so there are a lot of big issues that we could be tackling here in our own country that you know, as we continue to spend more than what we have, it becomes really challenging to do so. Just to put this into context from an audience that heard that number, 122% of GDP, that would be the equivalent of if you have a salary, an annual salary of $60,000, you've got debt of somewhere around $73,200. So you're literally not only spending above your means, but you're outspending what you're actually bringing in. And eventually, and I agree with Jamie Dimon, I mean, it's an unsustainable course. Now, you know, Donald, I remember maybe 20 years ago when the debt to GDP ratio was approaching somewhere around 80% of GDP. Yeah. Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles went around the country sounding the alarm, saying that we needed to do something in regards to being better fiscal stewards. We needed some kind of an austerity program. Why don't you hear those same alarm bells going off now that we're at 122% of GDP?
Yeah. Honestly, there's not much courage left in Washington. If you just want my frank opinion about it, I think, you know, I say in the early part of the piece that you're referencing, you know, people want to talk much more about things that they fabricate as a crisis than an actual crisis. You know, Rick Scott, a Republican from Republican senator from Florida, wants to talk about the national security issue of Chinese garlic. Okay, man. I mean, come on, we got bigger problems. Or, you know, AOC, I can't think of her, Ocasio-Cortez from New York, wants to talk about how we need to keep spending that UN program, whose workers may have actually helped Hamas on the October 7th attack. But nobody actually wants to sit down and do the hard thing. You know, it's hard to pass a budget. State lawmakers in our state do it every year, and almost every state has a constitutional requirement that they have to have a state government balanced budget. But we've not had a balanced budget in Washington, D.C. since 1997 in the Clinton administration. And nobody wants to sit down. You know, it's not sexy to sit down and figure out where we need to cut spending and where we need to increase revenue and that sort of thing. And people made a big deal about the Trump tax cuts a couple of years ago. And I thought that the Trump tax cuts were a great idea. I was with Americans for Prosperity at the point and was a big proponent of them. But none of those Republicans who voted for those tax cuts wanted to sit down and talk about, well, where are we going to cut spending at the same time? Nobody wants to have that hard conversation. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that Social Security is not sustainable. Medicaid and Medicare are not sustainable. I think it's funny that there are a lot of candidates for Congress right now who were state legislators just a few years ago who voted to expand Medicaid, which, by the way, is all deficit spending at the federal level. But, you know, they're going to run on the Republican ticket as budget hawks, and they're really going to control spending in Washington when they didn't help federal spending at the state level. I think, you know, if we had more people that were just willing to say, hey, I want to be in Washington for, you know, somewhere between 2 to 6 years, I want to get us on a sustainable fiscal path, and then I want to be done, then that's the kind of bravery that we need in Washington. But instead, they want to clamor for the next 30-second soundbite.
Yeah, actually, I grew up here in Lexington. My folks moved here in 1965. They met at the School for the Deaf in Morganton, and textiles and furniture were booming in the late 60s. And so they came here and worked in furniture factories for their whole careers, actually. And as everyone knows, the furniture, textiles and furniture jobs actually, you know, left our communities and left a void in our communities. And I decided after spending about 30 years in the pharmaceutical and medical communications field to retire and started to follow local politics more closely, how decisions get made and candidly, sometimes how they don't. And so for me, wanted to be able to apply the experience that I had built in the private sector and apply it to a community that really wrapped its arms around me and my sister as we were growing up with two parents that were disabled, and wanted to be able to give back in that way. And so decided to put my name in the hat for mayor in the last election. And it turns out that it was a shorter term than normal. We usually have a 2-year term, but due to COVID and waiting for the census results, it ended up being a year and a half. So I served an abbreviated first term, was ready to do it again, and was happy that the citizens here in Lexington agreed with my vision and wanting to continue to move our city forward in a major way. And it was very, very gratified to see the results coming out of the election last week.
You know, I love stories where people actually go off, make a success out of themselves, but don't forget home. You know, almost like the prodigal son, you find your way back home to also make a contribution and use your time and talent to benefit your local community, the community that bred you. And I think that's a great story. It's actually, I think it's the story of so many mayors across North Carolina. And I always think that's impressive. Well, I want to say applause to Lexington for having nonpartisan local elections. I've been a huge advocate for that. I've talked to a lot of my friends in the General Assembly. I personally think all local races should be nonpartisan. I mean, school board, county commissioner, city council. I personally, you know, I am a Republican, but I personally don't believe that Republicans or Democrats have some monopoly on how to fix potholes or make sure the trash gets picked up on time or whether or not the police shows up when you make a phone call. And so I think what happens by having these partisan races that some of these national issues that, quite frankly, are creating a huge partisan divide, you know, at a national level, sometimes they creep down and they insert themselves in these local races when, in fact, these local races is not the place for those types of debates. So, you know, if any of my friends that are in the General Assembly are listening today or happen to hear this, I renew my call. I think all these local races should be nonpartisan. To make sure we just get the best people in office, not necessarily someone from one specific party or the other. You mentioned you were just in a short period of time, 18 months before you had to run again. You were just figuring out where the bathroom was in City Hall, and then you had to file. What were you most proud of in that short 18-month period? What did you feel like you got done that really caused your message to get out there to voters?
You know, I think it follows along what you were just talking about, Algernon. In fact, I happen to be a Democrat, but I will tell you, I've been a registered Republican previously. I've been unaffiliated, and just now I'm a registered Democrat. But, you know, one of the things that I have found locally is that it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican, unaffiliated. To your point, if you're looking at issues like potholes and sewer, you know, it doesn't matter how you align. It's about sitting down with decision makers and stakeholders and getting things done. And one of the things that I'm proudest of is the time that I've spent with the Davidson County Commissioners, building that relationship. It was contentious. Prior to coming into office, I knew that was one of the things that I needed to spend some time focused on, building that trust. And we have been able to do that. I would say that's one of the things I feel proudest of in my first term, being able to sit down and discuss with them what their needs were. We talked about potholes and sewer. Sewer just happened to be the thing that that they really, really needed. They needed additional allocation. We were able to work out an agreement where we were able to increase their allocation for the benefit of the greater county from an economic development standpoint. And then also in exchange for that, able to receive some monies from them, some capital to go towards our infrastructure improvement. So that's a really big thing. The second thing I would say that I'm probably most proud of is the fact that we've been able to continue economic development in a major way here in Lexington. We're growing. We had an announcement in March and groundbreaking in August of Siemens Mobility. Siemens Mobility is a passenger rail manufacturer, and they were looking for a place on the East Coast to service their clients, and started with 37 different sites, narrowed it down to two, between Lexington and Greenville, South Carolina. And we were able to come to the table, reach an agreement with Siemens. We also included our county commissioners, North Carolina Department of Commerce, community colleges, multiple stakeholders coming together to make sure we had an incentive package that was attractive to Siemens Mobility. And they made a decision to invest $220 million in a manufacturing facility here in Lexington, bringing 500 plus jobs, which is a game changer for us. It also aligns nicely with the work that we've been doing, myself as well as previous administrations, in and around what we call the Depot District, Depot District revitalization. And some of your listeners may have heard that we received a $25 million federal grant to bring a passenger rail stop back to Lexington. And we received that grant. We're planning to break ground next year. It's about a 3.5 year project, but that's going to be one of the major catalysts for revitalizing our Depot District area. And we've approved 120 unit multifamily housing in and around the Depot District with a mixture of retail as well as 1 and 2 bedroom apartments. A lot of things happening in and around the Depot District revitalization, but I would sum it up to say that Lexington is in the passenger rail business, because we're going to be making passenger rail cars here. We're going to have a passenger rail stop. And if you've been following the North Carolina Mayors Association, they've been working hard to increase the number of passenger rail legs that we're requesting from the federal government. And this year, are requesting up to 12 different new legs of passenger rail travel. The two that I'm probably most interested in are the ones from Salisbury to Asheville, as well as the high speed rail from Raleigh to Northern Virginia, because Lexington will be right on the pathway to be able to get to Asheville and also be able to get to Northern Virginia, just further, I think, emphasizing Lexington's ability to be a destination location, not only on barbecue festival day, but every day of the year. Super excited about that.
I do enjoy barbecue festival day. You guys get me down every year for that. You know, I love all of what you just shared, because I do believe Lexington has become a real triad regional player. I think many of your citizens and probably several of your business owners down there would tell you that I've become a huge fan personally of Lexington. In fact, when we did Restaurant Week, we actually used Davidson Speed Printing in Lexington as our partner. For Restaurant Week. So I'm a huge fan of Lexington. I love some of the announcements that I've been hearing in terms of the job creation. I definitely have watched the development of the Depot District for a long period of time. I also want to give a big shout out to Tammy Absher. I think she's doing incredible work on behalf of the city, not only just in the Depot District, but really citywide. And you've got some great business owners down in that uptown Lexington. I have to get it right. You guys call it uptown, not downtown. So I'm a huge fan of everything you guys have been doing, and I'm certain you're going to try to keep all that energy and momentum going. We'll also maybe have to look at getting you back in here to talk more about this passenger rail issue that you just mentioned. I think that sounds fascinating. And to my audience, so grateful for you. Thank you for locking in with me. Make sure you stay tuned to WTOB, because that is where the Locked In Show broadcasts every Sunday morning. But if you happen to miss me there, hopefully you're subscribed to the podcast. You can always download that on Spotify, Pandora, Apple, wherever you like to get your favorite podcast. You can always lock in there. And until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.